What's it like to be in the room where it happens? Hardly anyone has had such a front row seat to recent American history as Senator Amy Klobuchar. Since becoming Minnesota's first female U.S. Senator, Amy has become a leader in the Democratic Party, run for president, and helped certify Joe Biden's victory in the face of the January 6th riots. Now she's written a memoir about these momentous events, as well as her more personal and family experiences with cancer, Alzheimer's, and COVID-19. Her book is The Joy of Politics: Surviving Cancer, a Campaign, a Pandemic, an Insurrection, and Life's Other Unexpected Curveballs. And she joins us now to share five key insights.
Hello, I'm U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. Today I'm going to share with you five of the key insights from my new book, The Joy of Politics. Now that title is real, it's not sarcastic. The book is about overcoming life's many curveballs. For me, over the last few years, that's meant surviving cancer, a presidential campaign, a pandemic where I almost lost my husband, and an insurrection, and still moving forward with joy. Because to me, there's a lot of joy in politics. There's a joy in doing and actually getting things done. And there is a joy in serving. Insight number one, there's joy in doing good. And as I note in this book, you always start where you are, not where you thought you would be or where you want to be, but where you are. There is no sugarcoating it. There isn't a lot of joy when you find out you have breast cancer. And there's certainly no joy in the surgeries and radiation's aftermath, with assorted but not unexpected hot flashes and various other medical challenges. Yes, there were the devoted doctors and nurses and my friends and family who were there with me every step of the way. There was the gratitude and lessons learned that you should never take anything or anyone for granted. But most of the joy in that time of healing came from knowing that by making the diagnosis public, I could help others. In working on the final draft of this book, I made some phone calls to check out with people things I had written or the facts. I had never spoken to or met Melissa of Maple Grove, Minnesota, a woman who sent me an unsolicited letter about how the public disclosure of my diagnosis of breast cancer had motivated her to go in for a long-delayed cancer test. In the brief letter, she explained that she found out she had stage 2 breast cancer and was in the course of getting treatment. But when I called her to ask if it was okay to use the letter and her first name, I had no idea what the outcome of her treatment was. The most bizarre part was that when I called her, she actually answered the phone from the waiting room of a suburban breast cancer clinic, where she was calmly awaiting her first mammogram checkup after her cancer surgery and treatment. While I still have never met Melissa in person, I pictured her that day in her clinical gown tied in the back, in the slippers they give you to wear, with a cup of coffee in her hand. Both Melissa and I decided that the timing of my call was a positive sign. I asked her to call me back with the results. A few days later, she did. She was 100% good. Okay, God, I thought, I get it, and you don't have to make it so obvious. I did something good. That's the joy of doing good. In working on the final draft of this book, I made some phone calls to people I had written about or featured in stories to check out the facts. Insight number two, being a political spouse is not an easy job. In 2020, way before there was a vaccine, my husband got really sick with COVID. He ended up in the hospital. He had pneumonia and his oxygen saturation levels fell below 70%. After 6 days in the hospital, hooked up to oxygen, and another few weeks of a lonely quarantine, he was fine, save for one and only one long-haul symptom. He claimed the dust in our basement, and only that dust, prevented him from ever cleaning out the basement again. In truth, John's illness put a lot of things in perspective. You see, my husband had done everything and anything for me throughout my career in politics. From the beginning, in 1998, when he meticulously typed in and individually verified permission for 1,000 supporters to include their names on a newspaper ad for my county attorney campaign, to the 2020 presidential run when he traversed the country in an Amy for America t-shirt. From parades in Minnesota to church parking lots in South Carolina to casino basements in Nevada, he was always there for me. You get way too used to that in my profession, the spouse sacrificing his or her own ambitions and time and life for you, urging you to run in the first place, patiently waiting through your political slights of the day, bending at the knees in the family Christmas card photos so you don't look too short, stepping in when you are cornered by a long-winded political science professor, and with a hand on the guy's back, you say, "Have you met my husband?" or "Have you met my wife?" Packing the school lunches, doing the daycare pickups, giving up jobs and proximity to family and friends, and moving across the country. Being a congressional political spouse is a whole thing, and it's often a really raw deal. That joke I just made about the dust aversion and John not wanting to clean the basement and it being his only COVID long-haul symptom, it is actually Exhibit A. It's 100% true, and he said it to me in all seriousness to avoid cleaning the basement, and I laughed really hard because I knew how much he hated hauling stuff out of there. Now, in most marriages, it would be a funny story to share at the Thanksgiving dinner table that gets exaggerated and larger than life over time. But for the political spouse, it ends up as a cocktail party fundraiser, or in a speech, or worse yet, on TV. And just because he smiles and laughs along with everyone else doesn't mean he likes that you brought it up, no matter how well-meaning. It's done. You said it. What's he supposed to do? 20 years into my life in politics, I remember a late night over beers at my husband's high school class reunion when a woman I had never met before came up to me and said, "You know, it's so funny. It was always John who we thought would run for office. That's what we predicted. I guess in a way he ended up doing it anyway." I wanted to say, actually, it isn't that funny. Yes, we did it. But in the end, it was all about me. It was always me on the debate stage. It was always my name on the campaign signs. It was always my name on the ballot. Insight number 3, how to make friends in politics, or as I call this part of the book, frenemies. In the crowded field that was the Hunger Games of the Democratic 2020 primary, I spent an amazing year crisscrossing the country, taking part in multiple nationally televised debates and sparring with my opponents, most of them ending up as friends. But a lot happened along the way. Of course, there were the debates and parades and forums and town hall meetings. Bernie, Pete, and I did 2 on Fox. CNN made a ritual out of individual candidate town halls, often the night before the debates. Then there was the time at the Los Angeles PBS Politico debate at Loyola Marymount University, when I quickly realized that the pen they had given me to write things down at the podium ahead of the debate didn't work. In fact, it exploded ink on my paper, putting me at an obvious competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis my opponents, who were all madly scribbling down their talking points. In the arc of political debates, this pre-debate podium time period is always critical, as candidates are allowed to crazily write down their thoughts in 3 to 5 minutes before the debate goes live, so they don't miss a key point or a stat or a joke. It was a stark disadvantage to have no working pen, and the debate rules forbade you from bringing out your own. And going backstage for a pen would have lost me precious minutes. The solution? First, Bernie, who was standing to my right, okay, that alone is funny, noticed and handed me his officially supplied pen and used his own instead. That's when I learned that most of the men were surreptitiously tucking a spare pen in their suit jacket inner pockets just in case the debate supplied pens didn't work. Then, when the pen Bernie gave me also didn't work, Tom Steyer, on the podium to the left of me, took out his stash pen and gave me my third official pen. And yes, the third time was a charm. Now, years later, I would like to thank those two guys for sneaking in the pens, as it was one of my best debates of the season. Insight number four, the union shall go on, also known as how we saved our democracy. After the insurrection was over, after the police officers had cleared the Senate chamber, it was 3:30 a.m., and there were only two senators left. Roy Blunt and I still had a job to do. With the young people carrying the mahogany boxes of ballots, along with Vice President Pence, we walked past the statues of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson and Rosa Parks. That walk was the exact same one the three of us had taken 13 hours before. The first time we had a long procession of our colleagues, there had been a sense of ceremony and celebration. Now this time, it was just the three of us. No other senators were there. Now it was silence. Glass was broken, windows were taped up, offices were in shambles, but we walked. Sometimes when you do things in Congress, you realize later that they are really big deals, but you were so caught up in the moment that it didn't feel like it at the time. This time, it felt like it. We knew what that walk meant. At the end, Senator Blunt and I, and House Leaders Zoe Lofgren and Rodney Davis, signed multiple copies of the certified votes from the rostrum. All the votes were in. Vice President Pence and I announced the final vote. At 4 a.m., Roy and I then walked back to the Senate. We stopped on the first floor to see all the damage that had been done to the individual offices, including the parliamentarians. I remember seeing one of the personal family photos of a beloved parliamentarian staff member strewn and seemingly broken on the floor. I wanted to make it better. I wanted to pick it up and put it back so she wouldn't see it like this in the morning. But I knew that everything should be preserved as evidence for the investigation. The offices looked like crime scenes. In fact, they were. As we left the torn-up office, I gave Roy Blunt a hug. "See you tomorrow," he said, with his typical understatement. Daybreak was approaching. There was one thing I knew for sure as I left Roy in the corridor. I would see him tomorrow. And when tomorrow came, our democracy would still be there. Insight number five, America might be the greatest song the world has yet to hear. In March of 2022, I attended the annual Fulbright Prize Dinner in Washington, D.C. It was a memorable evening because it was one of the first big in-person gatherings in Washington since the beginning of the pandemic. There we were, all dressed up, and we finally had a place to go. The honoree was Bono, the celebrity rock star who never rests on his laurels and instead uses his time and clout to do the hard work of persuading people in power to invest in curing diseases and repairing the world. By the time I left, my friend Senator Mark Warner took me aside and said, "I think we just heard the best speech ever." Bono's theme, "America might be the best song the world has yet to hear." His point, our song is just not done yet. Actually, none of our songs are done yet. I wrote this book because I believe that it is on all of us, as citizens, as elected officials, as people who simply want to pass on a better world to our kids and grandkids, to look for the good and do it. We must, as the inaugural poet Amanda Gorman reminded us when she read her poem in that bright yellow coat under that perfect blue sky of the 2021 inauguration, we must find light in this never-ending shade. That means being honest about not just our country's shortcomings, but also our strengths. Generations of our fellow Americans gave us their all, adding up to, in Bono's words at the Fulbright speech, 246 years of inching and crawling towards freedom, sometimes on your belly, sometimes on your knees, sometimes marching, sometimes striding to uphold the ideal of democracy. I figure it is on all of us to continue that march, the long strides, and yes, the inching and crawling to uphold the ideal of democracy. So that's how I go forward. With a deep love of our country and the realization that our work is never done. Not everything turns out as we want, but there are still many paths ahead. But most of all, I go forward with joy, with a spring in my step, to a tune that's not yet finished. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you, Amy. That was Senator Amy Klobuchar with 5 big ideas from The Joy of Politics, Surviving Cancer, a Campaign, a Pandemic, an Insurrection, and Life's Other Unexpected Curveballs. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.